Since 2020, we've gone from one property to, I think we have 30 now or something like that, about 35 units. And it's been a blast. Definitely a real estate investing buff. It completely changed my life because, you know, our housing payment is the most expensive thing that we pay for each month. So if you can eliminate the biggest expense that you have each month, it's absolutely life-changing for many, many, many people.
House payment is $1,400 a month, but your garage, which is detached, income is $1,800. And then on top of that, you're making roughly $800 a month from the basement.
Yeah, and that's where I live.
I mean, the whole notion that you could live somewhere for basically for free or even make money off of what you already own. I mean, that sounds amazing.
But when you see the numbers, man, when you see like how quickly you can add value with a few swings of a hammer, with a little bit of sheetrock and paint, man, it just kind of becomes addicting. Biggest mistake I've ever made. Oh man, gosh, selling anything. I think everything I sell, I'm like, man, we should have held that longer.
All right, welcome to another episode of Real Estate Development Land to Legacy. I'm trying out this new studio, so let me know in the comments what you think about it. But my guest today is Cameron. We just met a few days ago when I was on his podcast, and we got to talk about all kinds of things real estate and development related, and I wanted to bring him in to share some of his stories. So Cameron, welcome. Why don't you introduce yourself and let's jump into it.
Eugene, great to be with you again, man. I loved having you on the Legacy Investor podcast. I'm Cameron Filgreen. I grew up in Kansas City and moved to Waco about 6 years ago. It was about the time I moved to Waco that I definitely got the real estate investing bug. Started listening to Bigger Pockets, Graham Stephan, read a bunch of books, and started setting goals with my wife. So we started out with one house that we lived in, and we house hacked and we Airbnb'd the other rooms and rented out the other rooms, and then moved from there into another house hack, which is where I still live. We rent out the basement, rent out our garage. Since 2020, we've gone from one property to, I think we have 30 now or something like that. About 35 units, and it's been a blast. Definitely a real estate investing buff. I believe in real estate and absolutely love it, and love the passive income and the appreciation and the tax benefits and everything that's powerful about real estate. I am a huge fan. So now I'm teaching other people how to do it and going on podcasts and getting into bigger stuff. I'm under contract on a big commercial property. It's basically two blocks of commercial property. Something like 16 units, very dilapidated. Some of it's rented, some of it's not. So that's going to be the biggest thing I've ever done. And that kind of brings us to today. So that's kind of where I'm at for the audience to know who they're listening to. Coming in with a lot of experience with the Burr method and flips and sub two, creative finance, seller finance. You know, not as much land like you, Eugene, but hey, I can be convinced. I'm just a big real estate investing fan. So that's me. That's Cameron.
Awesome. So yes, basically full spectrum. So I just recently learned house hacking term. Do you mind explaining what it is?
Yeah. So house hacking is bar none. I think it's the best way to get into real estate investing, learn kind of the ins and outs, obviously buy real estate and see if you even like it, you know, like see what you think about trying to learn how to be a landlord and collect rent and write a lease and all that. And maybe it's Airbnb. That's the way you house hack. But what it is where you move into a homestead, a primary residence, an owner-occupied residence. You know, you live in the house and then rent out other areas of the house that offset your monthly mortgage payment. So, you know, that might just be a nice extra income for you, depending on your job or your W-2 or how much money you make, or it could completely change your life. And for me, it completely changed my life because for most of us, you know, our housing payment is the most expensive thing that we pay for. Like for most people, it's the most expensive and the biggest expense they have each month. So if you can eliminate the biggest expense that you have each month, it's absolutely life-changing for many, many, many people. For the wealthier and elites, house hacking is not going to move the needle. But for most people, it really is a huge expense that if you can get that to zero or close to zero, it's going to really change your financial picture and financial future. So like for us, we live in this house. I rent the garage. Well, I'll be really transparent and just give you real numbers. We pay $1,444 to live here. And the house was in really bad shape when we got it. We added a bathroom. We fixed up the garage apartment. And so I pay $1,400 a month, but the garage apartment alone, which is 500 square feet, completely detached from the house, they pay $1,800 a month. So that by itself completely pays my living expense. Doesn't include utilities, of course, but pretty much like knocks out my housing payment altogether. And then we rent the basement for $750. I say measly because we could rent it for a lot more, but we have three little toddlers living upstairs and it's loud. And, you know, we just want whoever's down there, we want them to feel comfortable with that. And so it's a perfect setup for us. And so that's house hacking. And we started off doing that with Airbnb. We've had roommates before. Now we have little kids in the roommates' rooms and they're not paying rent, believe it or not. And that's house hacking. And so I'm a huge, huge fan. If your lifestyle can allow for it, if you and mostly enjoy people. Every house that we look at to live in, I'm looking for where's the house hacking opportunity. So we're looking to move right now and we have this house in mind and every house we are looking at, I'm like, where's the additional dwelling unit? Where's the basement that we can block off? Or where's the extra garage space that we can put a kitchen in there? You know, that's just the way I think. And I think that's the really helpful way to start getting into real estate.
House payment is $1,400 a month, but your garage, which is detached, income is $1,800. And then on top of that, you're making roughly $800 a month from the basement.
Yeah. And that's where I live.
So for me, you know, as a developer, we obviously always talk about construction and regulatory issues and permits and all that. Is that all permitted and sort of legal, or is it just kind of under the radar? Yeah. You're doing it on the site?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's all legal. The garage apartment, I did it all myself and I didn't like pull permits or anything like that, but it was already a dwelling and the garage itself was already permitted and built like, you know, 30, 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of updated it essentially and made it more palatable for living. It was already there. But yes, absolutely. And believe it or not, ADUs are becoming more and more popular in legal jurisdictions because of the housing crisis. And like, we need more housing. And so they're making it easier for people to build a garage or a dwelling unit in your backyard. A lot of times the rule, at least here, is like, it can only take up a percentage of the acreage that you have. And so, yeah, definitely want to pay attention to the rules and everything, but it's becoming easier and easier. If you are someone who wants an ADU, whether it's to rent it out or to have family stay there or whatever.
I just want to point out that only somebody from Texas could be using the term acreage in the context of single family homes.
Yeah.
But no, you're right. We're seeing ADU laws being adopted in many states and it is changing the landscape. And even when we're looking at maximizing the density for completely brand new construction, new development, we're now factoring ADUs into that pro forma. So for example, in this one jurisdiction that I'm researching, they're allowing one house per, I believe, 6,000 square feet. But the state law also requires every municipality to approve detached or attached ADUs. So now this 6,000 square feet property can have the main house and can have an ADU. There are some restrictions in some municipalities, like this particular one, they're saying that ADU cannot be bigger than the house. In some areas in Seattle, we're actually able to do a triplex by calling it main house with two ADUs. So it's literally three identical townhomes, but we call one of them as the main house. And then, I don't know, there may be some minor variances, you know, maybe a couple hundred square feet.
I'm curious, is that like a recent law that passed?
Yeah, so in Seattle, the state of Washington adopted it, I believe, a year, maybe 2 years ago.
And oh my gosh,
Their requirement
is... housing shortage.
Exactly, and especially you've probably seen in the news all the homelessness in Seattle and most West Coast cities. So in Washington, every city, every municipality has to adopt that state mandate by, I believe, middle of this year. So pretty soon, every single city and county in the state has to adopt it. So you can build, in this state, two ADUs. So one could be attached, one could be detached.
Cool.
And then different municipalities could interpreted differently. So in your case, with your main home, did you run any numbers before you sort of jumped into it, or was it kind of intuition-based?
Intuition, and honestly, it's because of COVID. We were Airbnb in our other house, and we're like, well, Airbnb's not going to work, and we can't be in close proximity with anybody, so like, let's just get a new house and like move out of this thing and rent it out. So that's what we did. Turned out to be a good move, and we absolutely love this place. It doesn't mean we're going to be here forever, but I mean, we looked at a few places, and everyone has a homestead. Everyone lives somewhere. And so whenever you're moving to your next place, just keep your eye out for the ADU potential, for roommate potential, Airbnb potential. And I say potential because a lot of times it requires some creativity. You know, we had to put up walls. We did a fair amount of work to get the layout right and the flow right. And that's often what it takes. So just as you're looking at places, keep your eye out for that kind of thing and start thinking like an investor. If you don't already, it'd be a good move. I think it was a good move, and I'd encourage everybody to do it.
Yeah. So personal question, I suggested to my wife, because we have this daylight basement that we rarely use, set up for movie theater, but we honestly rarely use it. So I said, why don't we rent it out? She looked at me like, are you fucking crazy? Like, we're not going to rent out. Like, do you want strangers living in a house, like in the basement? No, like, absolutely not. How do you deal with that?
I think like I said earlier, like, it kind of depends on your personality. You know, if you don't want to have people in your house, then don't do it. You know, I think it's a smart move, but not every smart thing out there is for everybody. You know, there's a lot of smart things that I don't do that you don't do. So, because we just don't want to, it doesn't jive with us, whether it's a values thing or a personality thing. So yeah, lifestyles are going to change. Our lifestyle is going to change. You know, my 2 to 3 year vision is like, we're not house hacking anymore. I don't want to be doing it forever, but I love it right now. Love the extra income, but it won't be that way forever. So just like, yeah, you know, take it 1 year at a time.
No, for sure. I mean, the whole notion that you could live somewhere for basically for free or even make money off of that you already own. I mean, that sounds amazing. So tell me about your construction experience, new development. When you and I spoke before, you mentioned you had challenges running permits, dealing with contractors, dealing with the city. I want to hear a story, something that was absolutely ridiculously bad, and then something that was absolutely incredibly good.
I've had so many challenges with construction, with the city, with permits. What people don't tell you when you get into real estate investing, what they don't talk about much in the podcasts, in the books, is how much of real estate investing, if you really want to create value quickly, is how much construction is involved. And I didn't really know that. I happened to have done some construction when I was in middle school with my dad a little bit. I've swung hammers before. But when I got married and kind of I was in the photography, creative kind of video world, I did not have any desire to do construction. But when you see the numbers, man, when you see like how quickly you can add value with a few swings of a hammer, with a little bit of sheetrock and paint, man, it just kind of becomes addicting. And so I started off doing a lot of work myself. So I'll tell you a story, like first true Burr method house we did, which is buy, rehab, rent, refinance, repeat. We still have this house on Fifth Street here in Waco. You can find videos of this house on my Instagram, possibly if you do a deep dive, but we bought it and fixed it up all ourselves. We spent about 3 or 4 months, my wife and I, like every day we were there, 6 days a week, swinging hammers. And we didn't know, I mean, we didn't really realize how big of a project it was. Like, it was a full gut, I mean, down to the studs, everything you can imagine. We did it, windows, insulation, I mean, sheetrock. Now, we did hire some of it out. I hired sheetrock and HVAC, but everything else, like floors, cabinets, I did all the electrical, I did all the drains, all the water lines, and just like learned my way through it. I mentioned this particular house for two reasons. One, because we learned the hard way, like that you need permits to do this kind of work. And so, you know, we got red tagged. We had an inspector drop in on us and he's like, hey, I saw there's some pipe hanging out of your truck there. You know, what are you doing? And he walked in. Of course, the house is gutted. And so we had to get like a licensed plumber and electrician to like check our work as we did it. But I wired the whole house, like did everything. The other reason I mentioned that story is because it sucked and it taught me that I didn't want to be doing that kind of work. Like, I've got to scale my real estate portfolio past myself. Like, I can't And I just can't, I shouldn't be doing that kind of work if I want to scale and be, you know, doing the smarter stuff, working on the business, not in it, so to speak. And, but I'm also so thankful for that experience. And I actually would encourage a lot of people, if you wanted to get into, if you want to get into real estate, like learn a little bit about construction and like get your hands dirty a little bit so that you kind of understand what you're looking at. I'm really thankful for it in that way. Little fixes that I have on rental properties these days, like something that would cost $200 and it would take someone 10 minutes. Like I just run over it and fix it real quick if it's an electrical thing. The only reason I can do that is because of this experience, like wiring that whole house and learning my way through it. And so there's a lot there. I guess the whole point is like, you know, learning these things is important, but it shouldn't be like a forever thing. And I think that it's probably smarter for you to try to get yourself out of, you know, not putting a tool belt on and hiring the trades, hiring professionals to like do the construction work. That's kind of where I landed after that project, but super thankful for it.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. And I have to say, by the way, for full disclosure, disclaimer, however you want to look at it, if you have never wired anything before or have never plumbed anything before, please get a professional, because those two things are actually life and safety related. You know, it's very easy to burn down a house if you don't wire it right. So, you know, I understand the position of that inspector who saw that and he's like, you shouldn't be doing that. Everything else, general carpentry, fine, you know, but electrical, plumbing, HVAC. Well, HVAC, you can't even charge air conditioners without a license. You can't buy the Freon to charge it. But
yeah, it's true.
But yes, electrical, I would highly recommend getting somebody who knows what they're doing. But your example is very interesting, because now that you know what it takes to get things done, first of all, it makes you appreciate the people that do it every day.
For sure.
And, you know, I bet it took you five times as long to wire the house as it would have taken a professional electrician who not only has all the tools on day one, but also knows how to get it done. But also it made you appreciate the work that engineers put in designing the space.
Yeah.
So in most single family construction, we don't have electrical engineers draw up the plans before you go in the field. Guys that do it all the time, they can kind of eyeball and get the house wired. When it becomes more complicated, when you have multiple units, it becomes a nightmare. And most cities wouldn't let you do it without an approved set of plans. So somebody has to draw it up, put a stamp on it, and they have to review and approve it. But also, it becomes very expensive. If you start running plumbing or if you start running electrical without a plan, that's going to get very, very expensive, because you're going to have to rework a bunch of stuff when something doesn't work. So, and I'm speaking from experience.
I can tell.
So when you got red tagged, I've been red tagged a few times over the last 20 plus years. How was that? And how's that interaction? And then what did you?
Five or six times.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean,
so tell me more.
Yeah. I mean, the first time it's complete shock. Like, that's going to cost me so much more money and blah, blah, blah. And yeah, I agree with you, man. Getting licensed professionals to do the dangerous work for sure. And I did have a licensed electrician look over all my work and everything. And it was great. And it turned out really well. But yeah, to be honest with you, every project I do, big or small, I usually will not pull permits, because I trust my guys and I know like all we use licensed people, but it just takes a lot longer. And sometimes with like bigger projects, there's no like anything commercial that you have to pull a permit. You have to get engineered plans. But you know, I'm fixing up this house down the street right now and we're doing cabinets, bathrooms, kitchen, putting some recessed lights in. And like, and you know, permits are a gray area where everyone kind of has their own opinion. But you know, I usually go without one, and then if I get red tagged, I'm like, okay, sure, we'll get permits. A lot of people might disagree with that, but the way I see it is like, you know, you need a permit to like jaywalk. You need a permit to like go 10 miles over the speed limit, and we don't like do that all the time. It's just one of those weird gray areas where I'm kind of willing to go without, and if the city wants to get involved, then they can. That's kind of where I'm at.
Right.
Longer when you get the city involved.
Exactly. As long as you understand the risk. So if you get caught, I mean, my people who know me, they would laugh at this, because I always say I'd rather ask for forgiveness than permission. And that bit me in the ass a bunch of times. But, you know, sometimes you have to make a judgment call, and as long as you understand the risk. You know, if you understand what the risk is and what's going to happen if you do get caught, you know, can you live with it? And so it's just like any other investing. You know, investing is risky. Development is risky. Yeah. Construction is risky. Somebody could fall off the second floor. People could die. Things happen. So as long as you know what the risks are and you're willing to accept it, go for it.
Yeah. And like, don't, I would encourage whoever's listening to this, like, don't get upset at the city. Like, all they want is for things to look good, to be safe. To, like, we went in Waco, we went so, there was so much, so many years where people got away without using permits, and there's all this really crappy work that happened. And so the work has like gotten a lot better because they're cracking down, you know, and that's great. And I'm really proud to say, like, we do really good work and really do professional work on all of our houses. And so sometimes we pull permits, sometimes we don't. It depends on how big the project is, but it's a good thing that the city is cracking down, and a lot of jurisdictions are cracking down from what I hear. So it's good.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's all about life and safety.
I'm in a podcast right now. Thank you. That was my little boy. Sorry.
That's awesome. Well, with that, let's see. What did I just had a thought. Now I'm thinking of chips. So when you are looking at new opportunities, new projects, what is your process? What do you go through? What's your evaluation process, feasibility process like?
Yeah. For commercial, I'm usually look, because your audience is a lot of land and commercial people. Like, I'm usually looking at how can I revitalize this like area or revitalize this whatever plot. The only commercial stuff I've done is like in the city. So, and the stuff I've done was like dilapidated real estate in an area where not much is happening, and I want to see some revitalization and growth. And that's what I've done. I you know, fixed up this one commercial property, put a coffee shop in and put a cigar lounge, and like it's brought tens of thousands of people to this random part of Waco, and we fixed up the spot next door. There's gonna be a clothing boutique, and it's slowly becoming this like beautiful redemption story of this corridor of Waco. And that's like my mission, is to bring the kingdom of heaven to earth through real estate investing, one house at a time. So, and I do that with houses too, revitalize the neighborhood. It's just different, obviously, with single family homes. So that's what I'm looking to do also with this upcoming project that we're closing at the end of the month. Is there's a lot of different directions this project could go. And I want to both revitalize the neighborhood and change the city of Waco, but also, you know, I think we'll have a healthy exit in about 3 or 5 years after it's all fixed up and rents are higher and everything else. Like, of course, we'll make some money. So that's kind of for the commercial side, is like, hey, let's revitalize the neighborhood and then believe for it, just like believe for the neighborhood and improve the neighborhood. And then like the numbers, the money will kind of follow. So that's just my personal philosophy on the larger projects and just like getting them. I'm not going to buy a commercial project for market value. Like usually I'm trying to get it under market value. You know, it's usually distressed property. Same with single family home. So I'm usually getting distressed property that needs work, and I'm getting it way under market value. So for single family homes, I go for about 70 or 75%, which means basically ARV after repair value times 0.75 minus the rehab equals my purchase price. So if there's anyone listening that's new, like if it's a $200,000 ARV, house needs $50,000 of work, then that's 200 times 0.75 equals 150 minus the $50,000 rehab. So we buy it for 100, put 50 into it. Now it's worth 200. I'll either sell for 200 and pocket whatever 30. This is just for the $200,000 case scenario, or refinance based on the $200,000 value and end up with zero cash in the deal, cash flowing rental property, $50,000 of equity. Those are my back of the napkin numbers for every single family home that I do. I just want to get less than 70% into the deal, and I'll do it. I'll flip like crazy, burr like crazy. The hard thing is finding the deals. That's the hard part these days.
Are those real numbers or are those hypothetical?
Most houses here in Waco, there's a lot of 250, 300 ARVs, even 200 ARVs. In some neighborhoods, there's parts of Waco where I've done some $400,000 and $500,000 ARV flips, and those are awesome. They're just great because you have a buyer for them and stuff. But there's still a lot of houses. I just use the number 200 because it's easy to do the math.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, it's amazing. Over here, you can't even buy a, an old dilapidated condo for that much.
Yeah, 100%, dude.
Biggest mistake you've ever made.
Biggest mistake I've ever made. Oh man, gosh, selling anything. I think everything I sell, I'm like, man, we should have held that longer. And I hear a lot of people say that, especially like 40 and 50 year old investors are like, man, if I had just held on to that one, it would be worth so much.
Have you tried analyzing though? You sold, you bought something else, made money there. Have you tried running that analysis? Would it have been better to just keep that?
That's a great thought, man. Yeah. I mean, everyone, this is what Grace Gudenkauf said on my podcast, is like everyone has a bottom 20% of their portfolio. Everybody. So, and she's like, you should always be considering selling your bottom 20%. And so I really took that to heart, and I have sold a couple of things, and I'm in the process of selling a couple. So like, yeah, everyone has a bottom 20%. And I don't think you'll regret selling that bottom headache 20% and exchanging it for, something with less headache or something bigger, or leveraging up again, with the biggest mistake thing. Nothing like immediately comes to mind. Praise the Lord. So I got into this SBA loan with a local bank, and I think the mistake was that I assumed the SBA and this local bank had my best in mind. It turns out I assumed that the SBA would have the best rates, and they didn't. I was paying on $750,000. I was paying 11.75% when rates started to go up a little bit. It was prime plus 2.75%. I was losing like $1,500 every single month on this commercial deal. So I just wish I had shopped that a little bit more. It would have saved me. There's also a prepayment penalty and like tons of origination fees. I think I would have saved something like $50,000-$60,000. That was a pretty big mistake. And just like not shopping enough. If there's any lesson for you guys to learn, it's to shop for those rates, to shop different banks and different, even like secondary market loans. I wish I had done that better. And same with contractors. Anything that you can shop, shop it. It doesn't cost you anything except for some time. I wish I had shopped that more. That's probably a big one.
How do you shop contractor?
Basically, either engineered plans or take them by the house, and I usually write down what I want to do with the house. And I usually will draw my own plans on SketchUp if it's going to be more complicated, and walk them through the house and explain the scope of work. I usually ask for labor only. So I'll pay for all the material. You just give me how much can you do this for labor wise? And hey, show me photos of your work and blah, blah, blah. And how fast do you think you can do it? Speed is a big one for me. If someone's going to take 6 months to do a single family home, I'm going to pay more, obviously, for someone who's faster. With engineered plans, I mean, it's so easy. Like once you have plans, just send them over to, you can email them to 50 people, and ask them for a bid, and then take like five of them and ask a few more questions. What's your timeline? Show me pictures of your work and just vet them a little bit more and walk the project. And, I don't always go with like the lowest possible bid. There's a lot to be said for a company's, whether it's mechanical, electrical, or plumbing, like how big they are, how many guys they have, what's their branding, what's their website. There's a big difference between hiring like the one person HVAC crew and the, 60 person HVAC crew if the prices are pretty close.
Yeah.
You have a lot more
How do
experience
you?
with that than me.
I have a lot of opinions, but obviously we've worked with small contractors, large contractors, and I've seen the interaction and I've picked the wrong bidder and I've picked the right bidder before and I've picked based on relationship. What I would like the listeners to have a better, be better prepared for, how do you ensure that you're comparing apples to apples? I mean, anybody can pick the lowest bidder. But what a lot of people don't know is what is hiding behind that number. There's a reason why one bidder's less than everybody else. How do you ensure that the one you pick didn't just promise you the fastest turnaround and then
To
ended
be
up taking
honest,
six
I would
anyway?
love to hear from you, Eugene, because I've found myself using the same guys because I just know the guys I trust. I know their pricing is going to be close to the, not the bottom, but like pretty good, pretty reasonable. With carpentry and mechanical, electrical, plumbing, so, and whatever, concrete, So, like, I'm curious how you do that.
Yeah, so I mean, we definitely talk to multiple subs or multiple GCs. We used to be our own GC general contractor. Now we work with GCs, but we do oversee their subcontractors or their choice of subcontractors. So we do have opinions on that. You know, it's always complicated, especially the more complicated the project is, the harder it is to make sure that you are looking at apples to apples. But the main thing is we always have the scope of work written out. Without the very detailed scope of work, it's very hard to know what's included in that price. I personally always insist on having the price broken out. I don't just need the total, because that total could be hiding so many things. I need to know what it consists of so that I could pick and choose, and so that I could decide what makes sense, what doesn't make sense, so that we could value engineer, you know, reduce the cost by swapping out some of the materials. And then what I typically tell my generals is, look, let's agree on your markup. I'm willing to pay you a fair markup, but that's going to be really the only thing that you're going to be competing against others. Because the scope of work, whatever you're actually including in that, cost of materials is cost of materials. I prefer paying subs to provide materials. And the reason, I know that I'm overpaying for them, but especially when it comes to MEP, mechanical, electrical, plumbing, if anything breaks and you do need to bring them back to fix it under warranty, even if it's the material's failure, you're still going to end up paying for their labor to come back and swap it out. Hmm. Yes, your supplier might replace the faucet or might replace the light fixture, but if you need to pay somebody to get it actually swapped out, you have to pay for their labor because it wasn't their material that failed. This way, my warranty is under one roof, and I don't care if it's the material failure or if it's the installation failure. I can just call them and have it replaced. But as long as you know what the risks are and you're comfortable with them, that's perfectly fine. There's no one rule, you know, do this or do that. It's whatever you're comfortable with. You can obviously save on the front end, but then may end up paying on the back end. And then the other thing that I always look at is exclusions. Most contracts have an entire list of exclusions that is not included in the price. And those exclusions are extremely important, because some of the things that they are excluding are things that you have to do anyway. And so now the question is, well, who's going to get it done? Is it going to be my own carpenter? Is it going to be another trade? Is it going to turn into a change order later? And the reason they excluded it is because they didn't know how to price it right now. And so those are the things that we have to have the conversation. And then, you know, with larger projects, with larger, when we were on GCs, we would have a team of people sit down and level the bids, basically trying to figure out what's included here, what's included there, and then try to figure out if we brought all the things that were excluded here into there and the other way around, then what is the total going to be? But I typically tell
investors... How many bids do you get on a big project?
It depends on the time. You know, this time of the market, middle of 2025, we could probably whisper about a project and we'll have a line out the door. 3 years ago, we would be begging subs to bid on the job. And we would send out a dozen RFPs and we'd be lucky if we get one response.
Gotcha.
So, you know, I generally like to have at least three to look at. As far as GCs, general contractors, I tell them right away, look, I don't care about your number. I don't want you to waste time estimating the job, especially early in the project. I like bringing GCs super early on when we just first started talking about it at conceptual design and schematic design. I like having a GC on board because I need somebody to help me estimate the cost of that project. For me to pick a GC, I would pay them pre-construction services. I would pay them an hourly fee or whatever we agree on to put their estimation team on the project and work with us, work with the design team to get the project estimated. But what I tell them is, I am going to ask you for your fee proposal. So tell me what your markup is. And then give me your budget for general conditions, general requirements. I just want to see what types of overhead they're throwing in the project. And they always, you know, fudge a little bit. They try to maximize their general overhead. I just want to see what that is. Everything else, I tell them, look, I don't care. I know that it's going to cost what it's going to cost. And, you know, my my philosophy is, as long as I'm comfortable with the guys, as long as we can go grab a drink after work, talk about religion and politics and not be mad at each other and still shake hands and go do a project, I think we can work together. Some companies, especially on large projects, you work with these big corporate GCs and they're too corporate. They're like guys in their sports coats or their company issued polos. And it's like, I don't know, if it feels too sterile, I don't like it.
Bro, you're at another level if you're working with GCs that have sport coats on. I've never experienced that. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's see. Before we wrap up, one quick question that I wanted to ask you, and it might end up being a long answer, but how do you typically finance your projects? You mentioned working with banks, SBA loans.
Yeah.
Do you work with outside investors? Do you self-fund? What's your strategy?
All right. So the commercial stuff, I'm using banks, usually, you know, putting 20% into the deal for the purchase, and then they're usually going to cover 100% of the renovation, somewhere around there. What I found with commercial stuff is you do have to be a lot more liquid. With single family, you don't have to have any money. I guess you could raise all the money for a commercial project. It's just you're going to give up a lot more in points and origination fees and interest. With banks, I'm fine. We're paying 7, 8, 9% with the bank. With single family, I really am passionate about this because a lot of newbie investors think that you have to come, like, they're like, I can't even buy my own house. I got to come up with all this with a down payment. And I just, you know, I can't do it. I don't know how people buy houses. I have compassion for that. With real estate investing, it's very possible to end up with zero of your own cash in the deal. Whether you have the cash at the beginning and then you exit and get your cash back, or you can use investors and they'll fund the entire purchase and the entire renovation. You never bring $1 to the table. That's what I typically do. I have a short list of private money lenders. These are people that you and I, listener, both know. If you don't think you know these people, you're wrong. You definitely know somebody that has $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 that's sitting there that's making 6%, and you could be offering them an opportunity to make 12% or 10%. On that money. So that's what I do, is I reach out to people on Instagram or call them up or text them or whatever and say, hey, I have this house coming up. You want to make 12%? And they'll wire the money to title. We buy the house, 100% of renovation. And then they do a, what's called a construction holdback. And they send me draws of 20,000 bucks or so whenever I need it, basically. And they'll fund the entire renovation. So that's what I do. And that's what I'd encourage most people to do is try to connect with those people. That's a huge reason I have a podcast and even put any time into social media and content. I'm sure you're similar. It's like, I want to build trust and show people I know what I'm doing and give people an opportunity to invest their money and make 12%. Like, that's pretty solid, no matter where you look. But that was a long answer, but that's how I'm funding my deals. I'm excited to get to the point where I need to raise 7 figures for a deal, like probably what you're doing. And I think I'm getting close to that moment. That'll be a fun one.
Well, hey, Cameron, thank you so much for your time and your experience. I think it was super useful. If somebody wants to get a hold of you, what's the best way to reach you?
Thank you so much for having me, Eugene. My Instagram is Cameron_Philgreen. My podcast is The Legacy Investor with Cameron Philgreen. And I do coaching. I have a course, an ebook. I have all that stuff for people to learn more, mostly about the Burr method, because that's what I kind of specialize in. So, yeah, reach out.
Awesome.